Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Washington is a tough beat for reporters and maybe tougher than ever in today's environment. Political gridlock coupled with complicated economic consequences as well as war and peace issues are ingredients of everyday reportage. NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro is right in the middle of all of this. He's been covering first the Justice Department and more recently the White House for more than a decade in all, winning numerous prestigious awards along the way. He is the first NPR reporter promoted to correspondent under the age of 30. That's quite an accomplishment. Ari Shapiro joined me in studio to record an interview last evening. He was in St. Louis to speak at St. Louis University. Ari, welcome. Nice to have
Thanks.
You with us.
Thanks. It's so good to be here.
Well, Washington dodged the bullet.
Yeah, you mean the snow bullet.
The
sequester bullet we didn't dodge. The snow bullet we dodged.
You came in a little early to avoid all
right.
of that never happened.
Yeah, didn't I kept calling people in D.C. and they said there's rain, there's slush, there's a little snow, nothing sticking.
Well, that's good. Good for them. Although you say you were disappointed, you didn't get a chance
we
to
We didn't
see
have
it.
A big snowstorm this winter. And other winters, it's been kind of fun every now and then to see people, you know, cross-country skiing down the street. So I thought if that had happened while I was away, I would have missed it, but didn't manifest.
Welcome once again to St. Louis, where we have no snow, fortunately.
Thank you.
Ari, you know, one of the questions that a lot of people are asking, I'm sure, is someone covering what's going on in Washington these days, the gridlock, the posturing, and all the rest of it, is it as frustrating for you and the media, the press, to cover this as it is for the rest of us to watch what's going on?
Absolutely, because you know where the compromise will be if they can reach the compromise. But for reasons that, you know, everybody in the media has explained again and again, they are not able to reach compromise until the very last second, if at all. But leading up to the very last second, they have to look like they're trying. So they'll have these marathon meetings, these back and forths. At least that was the case for the debt ceiling and the fiscal cliff and some earlier fiscal crises. For the most recent fiscal crisis of the sequester, they didn't even bother with that. But it's one of these things where the audience can see, well, if the Republicans are here and the Democrats are there, they're probably going to end up somewhere roughly between the two. And yet it just seems so difficult for the parties to get there.
Why, in your view, are we in this position now?
You can't give a single reason, but one reason that's very easy to point to is that the districts in Congress have been drawn so carefully that swing districts have more or less been eliminated. So Democrats and Republicans are not so much at risk of being ousted by somebody of the other party in a general election. The way the districts are drawn, they are more at risk of being ousted by somebody more to their extreme within their own party in a primary election. That means Republicans have less incentive to compromise with Democrats. Democrats have less incentive to compromise with Republicans because if they do compromise, they may be booted out of office in a primary by somebody farther to the left or right within their own party.
It's all about re-election.
It's all about re-election. You know, negative behavior has to have consequences. Otherwise, the negative behavior will be repeated. For members of Congress, the only consequence that matters is not being reelected. I have to give credit for that analogy to Amy Walter, an ABC News producer who talked about that during the fiscal cliff. She said, you know, if your kids are fighting in the car and you say, I'm going to pull over the car, and they keep fighting, you don't pull over the car, well, then they'll learn that there are no consequences. Mm-hmm. So the equivalent for members of Congress of pulling over the car and not getting dessert is not getting reelected.
You know, another bullet has been dodged, sort of, and that is that the House, pretty much along party lines, has passed that continuing resolution, which will fund the government beyond March 27th.
Mm-hmm.
Still has to go to the Senate.
Yeah.
Your view of that?
So there's been this lineup of fiscal crises, and it's easy to get cross-eyed thinking about the differences among them and, you know, which ones matter and which ones don't. There's the debt ceiling, the fiscal cliff, the sequester, and the one you're talking about is the funding for the government running out, and unless Congress passed a continuing resolution to keep funding it, government would just shut down. So the House Republicans decided, rather than try to get more concessions, they were going to keep fighting over the last fiscal crisis, the sequester. And so they passed a continuing resolution to keep funding the government at those reduced funding levels from the sequester, which President Obama has said he doesn't like. Obviously, he's trying to keep working with members of Congress to undo the cuts that are in the sequester. But he said that he will sign it because he doesn't want to see a total shutdown of the government.
Well, I want to tell our audience that they will not be given a pop quiz on all this.
I'm not sure I would pass such a pop quiz, frankly.
Well, you did a pretty good job of describing it, but it is complicated. And that's
yeah.
that's part of the problem as far as the public's absorbing all of this. It is complicated.
It's complicated, but at the end of the day, a lot of this keeps coming back to Republicans want to solve the nation's deficit problem through cuts alone. Democrats want to solve the problem through a combination of cuts and revenue increases, tax increases, closing loopholes, getting more money into the federal government. One problem, though, is that because the parties are not able to get some grand bargain agreement, the cuts that we see keep coming from domestic discretionary programs, which are, I don't know, under 20% of the entire federal budget. The sequester also included cuts to Pentagon spending, which is a big part of the federal budget. But the big entitlement programs and health care and the things that really, really drive the deficit, those have not been tackled.
We are seeing something that we haven't seen, with President Obama apparently reaching out to Republican legislators.
Yeah, having dinner at the Jefferson Hotel, a very posh Tony Hotel near the White House, with a group of Republican senators. One White House official said the president keeps, you know, saying he has a plan to deal with these sequester cuts, and Republicans keep saying he doesn't. This White House official, talking on background to one of my colleagues, said, if we have to buy them sea bass to prove to them that we have a plan, then we'll buy sea bass. But, you know, more generally speaking, this is a president who has not done a lot of socializing and meeting with people from the other party, or from his own party for that matter. And he always thought that it wouldn't really pay off. But in addition to this dinner, the White House now says he's going to meet with the Republican and Democratic caucuses on the Hill to talk about the legislative agenda. So they're clearly trying to add a different tool to their arsenal in hopes that maybe the kind of outreach that's not deadline-driven, that's not crisis-driven, could lead to better outcomes than he's had in the past.
What's your analysis of why President Obama has not reached out in the past? A lot of people are calling him aloof for not only reaching out to the Republicans, but members of his own party as well.
I think he is aloof personally. I think there's a small group of people who he feels comfortable with, who he enjoys socializing with, and he stays with that small circle. But you could imagine a president who was personally aloof and decided tactically, I'm still going to reach out to members of my own party and other party just to lubricate the channels of communication and make sure if I need them for something, they've been in touch with me. And that's something the White House has just simply decided not to do. When you ask them about it, they will say, going golfing with John Boehner is not going to get some kind of grand bargain on deficit reduction.
Or Tiger Woods, for that matter.
Who he golfed with in Florida. But at the same time, you look at the moderate Republican from Maine, the senator who just retired, Susan Collins or Olympia Snow. I always forget which is which. Snow just retired. When she retired, she said, you know, over President Obama's 4 years that she was also in office, she got maybe one, maybe two calls from him. Now, if there was anyone who the White House could have persuaded to jump the fence and side with Democrats on important legislation, it was Olympia Snow. And you would think that they would have reached out to her to try to make that happen, and they just didn't.
You would think that at least they could use Joe Biden for this sort of thing, because that's kind of what he does.
Well, and frankly, at the 11th hour with the fiscal cliff, they did. On a Friday afternoon, when it was sort of nearing the deadline, President Obama invited Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid from the Senate, Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner from the House, the four congressional leaders, two of each party. He invited them to the White House, and they went back after the meeting, said, I think we could have an agreement. And at the end of the day, it was Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell who hammered out that agreement. Mm. Joe Biden has a really long history in the Senate. So does Mitch McConnell. These guys are deal makers. But, you know, more than half the members of the Senate now have been there for six or fewer years. And it shows that the kinds of guys who knew how to make those deals from decades of working across the aisle just aren't there anymore.
Do you think in any sense it may be too late, this reaching out by the president to the Republicans, too late in the game?
Well, the problem, as I see it, is not that the president is unable to win over centrist Republicans. There are fewer centrist Republicans than there were before. But as I see it, the problem is that in the House of Representatives, John Boehner, who would like to cut a deal with the president on various things, who's been in Washington for a long time and understands the levers of power and knows how to compromise, John Boehner cannot make those deals because his right flank won't go along with it. You've had this really interesting John Boehner-Eric Cantor dynamic in the last few years. John Boehner, of course, is the House Speaker. Eric Cantor, the majority leader. Cantor aligns much more with the Tea Party wing of the Republicans. Boehner is more of a sort of old-school conservative Republican. And, you know, during the fiscal cliff negotiations, there was this incredible thing that happened where Boehner was going to present what he called Plan B, a more conservative option that the Republicans in the House would be able to vote for, Democrats in the Senate would knock it down, and then Boehner would be able to say, look, I tried to give the more conservative option. Now we have to go along with this centrist plan and we'll get a compromise. So Boehner offered Plan B, and to his shock and really humiliation, the Republicans in the House wouldn't go along with his more conservative plan that he put on the table just to give them something that they could vote for. And so it can't hurt for President Obama to reach out to Republicans who he thinks he can make a deal with. But at the end of the day, any legislation has to pass the Senate and the House. And in the House, those conservative Tea Party Republicans are not in a mood to compromise. And if they do, there's a real chance that they will be voted office by the same Republicans in their district who voted them in on a wave of change.
Yeah. Boehner's in a tough spot. He, too, wants re-election, but re-election to the House speakership or to maintain that job.
Exactly. And there are real threats that he could lose the House speakership. When he was voted just in January this year, House Speaker, there was a really extraordinary number of defections, which was kind of a shot across the bow.
The president and his education secretary and perhaps others that I haven't seen have been criticized for overstating the consequences of the sequester, saying that you mentioned Armageddon a little while ago, that you know, things are going to be felt immediately. That hasn't really happened.
Right.
Your assessment of that, did they overstate the consequences?
Well, there was a series of days last week. I was at the White House, and we had a different cabinet secretary come unannounced into the briefing room each day. So one day it was Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. One day it was Arne Duncan, the Education Secretary, as you mentioned. Another day it was Ray LaHood, the Transportation Secretary, saying we're going to have 90-minute waits at airports. They made it sound like this was all going to happen on day one in an effort to prevent it from happening at all. And then as we got closer to the deadline, it was clear this was not going to happen on day one. They started walking it back and saying, well, these things won't all happen at the first day, but it'll be a snowball that picks up speed as it goes down the hill. But they set people up to brace for the worst, and kind of like this snowstorm that didn't hit D.C. that made everyone think, oh, well, everything's going to be fine. And in the case of the snowstorm, maybe it is. People were really bracing for the worst in the sequester, and the fact that it didn't happen on day one certainly makes Republicans feel very vindicated. I don't know whether it's going to happen in the weeks and months to come, but I think the White House believes they did misjudge the strategy a little bit.
And how about people like yourself? Do you feel used when this sort of thing happens?
It's a perpetual dynamic in the White House press corps that they try to spin us and we try to fact check them. So Arne Duncan, the education secretary, comes into the White House and says, these teachers in this school district are going to be laid off and it's our responsibility to call that school district and then report that, in fact, although Arne Duncan said the teachers were going to be laid off, they aren't going to be laid off. And then the next day, go back to the White House and say, how do you explain this?
We talked at the beginning about the frustrations that reporters may feel in Washington and more evidence of it. Our guest in studio is Ari Shapiro. He is, of course, NPR's White House correspondent. We're going to continue our recorded discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro. And we're talking about his job and how difficult that can sometimes be, particularly in the current Washington environment. All right, we have some questions here that were pre-submitted because this is a recorded interview. One from one of our friends, Linda Honingford, who asks, and this relates to something we've talked about. We hear so much about the problems caused by the gerrymandering, the redistricting, I think is what we want to call it. But is there any chance that this system will change in the near future?
Well, if Republicans in charge of drawing the district. Let me actually take a step back and explain how these districts are drawn. In most cases, it is the state legislature that decides the congressional districts. And one reason that the districts now so heavily favor Republicans, in fact, in the most recent election, there were more a million more votes cast for House members in the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. Republicans still controlled the House because of the way these districts were drawn. The reason it favors Republicans so much is that 2010 was a wave election for Republicans, and Republicans took over state legislatures across the country. 2010 also happened to be a census year when the districts get redrawn. And so it was overwhelmingly Republicans that were redrawing these districts that favored Republicans. But now Republican leadership is feeling a backlash. As we've discussed, the people who are supposed to be able to lead the party are not able to lead the party because there are some who are so unwilling to compromise. The districts have become too safe. I don't know whether we're going to see state legislatures redraw the maps because they are not as answerable to sort of the hierarchy of the Republican Party as folks in Washington are. there is certainly a sense in Washington, I think, that Republicans may have, if not shot themselves in the foot, at least not done themselves any favors by drawing districts that are so, so crimson red.
In all fairness, we have to point out also that Democrats, when they're in the position the Republicans are,
does it when they can.
Yeah.
Republicans were just lucky enough that the year when people were able to do it most recently, 2010, happened to be a wave Republican year, so they got more opportunity to do it. But Democrats would definitely do it and do when given the opportunity.
I'm going to backtrack just a little bit here with regard to your job at the White House and the job of your peers. Much has been made recently of comments made by Bob Woodward about emails that he's exchanged with a White House person, seeming to indicate that the White House is using strong-arm tactics. Do you see any evidence of that sort of thing?
Well, the White House does occasionally use strong-arm tactics. In that specific exchange, it was really interesting the way that it played out. Bob Woodward had written an op-ed basically saying the president is to blame for the sequester. The White House pushed back. Bob Woodward leaked a portion of the email that was pushing back that seemed to suggest that White House officials were threatening him, saying, "You will regret this." And then the full emails came out. And we saw the exchange was between Gene Sperling, the economic advisor to the president, and Bob Woodward, who they're old friends. And the tone of the emails was extremely cordial, extremely warm. "As your friend, my apologies for raising my voice earlier. I appreciate that. Thank you. So I'll call you later." The narrative seemed to fall apart as we learned more about it. And, you know, it's a valuable lesson for those of us who are reporting on the news with partial information that you just have to be so careful until you have the full context. You can get out ahead of your skis very easily.
What was the buzz amongst your colleagues with regard to all of this? Because a lot of them I saw come out very publicly and really give a big thumbs down to Bob Woodward.
A lot of them did. You know, he is more in the business of writing books nowadays than he is in daily reporting. And obviously, everyone in Washington has enormous respect for him and for the work that he has done. But in this instance, a lot of people in Washington were scratching their heads.
What is your day like? Well, when you're White House correspondent, you do so many other things.
I do a couple other things. But
Let's talk about a typical White House day, and then we can talk about the other things.
So for context, I have to tell you there are three of us who cover the White House at NPR. It's myself, Scott Horsley, and Mara Liasson. And this is great because when you are in the White House, you really can't do anything but the daily treadmill of the president did, the president said. So we rotate weeks. I'll have a week at the White House, one out of three. And when it's my week at the White House, I get there in the morning and the president's schedule is my schedule. Whatever he's doing, I'm reporting on. And as often as not, I'm doing a story that day for All Things Considered, Morning Edition, sometimes both.
So you could be having dinner at the Jefferson tonight.
Well, actually, so there is a pool of reporters, which is one radio, one TV, one print, etc. And the pool rotates. Because some events that the president does, if he's, for example, meeting in the Oval Office with a visiting head of state, you're not going to have the entire press corps in there. You'll have the pool in there. And it happens to be NPR's day in the pool right now. And so when the president goes to dinner at the Jefferson, my colleague Scott Horsley will be in the motorcade. They're not actually going to be allowed in the dining room. But as I say, the president schedules our schedule. Generally, when I'm at the White House, each day there is a briefing with Jay Carney. NPR has a second seat in the center, and we'll ask him a couple questions. Most recently, when I was there, the president actually had a little news conference, and I got to ask him a question, which was exciting.
Good. And how often do you have to file? I mean, what is your routine with regard to disseminating whatever you learn during the
day? There's no strict quota, but obviously the hourly newscasts are always eager to have whatever sort of incremental news is happening. And then every day I talk with my editor, who edits all three of us who cover the White House and has a sense of what our short, medium, and long-term projects are and should be. So when it's not my week in the White House, she and I will talk about, well, you know, I think there may be something interesting to say about drones or about the relationship with Republicans or about the economics or politics of this issue or that issue. But it's not as though I have to get five stories a week. Otherwise, I, you know, get a pay cut or something.
What about some of the other assignments that you have? You did Talk of the Nation yesterday.
Yeah. I filled in guest hosting Talk of the Nation for a couple of days, which was really fun. It's just a totally different set of muscles. And the nice thing about having three White House correspondents is that as long as somebody is in the White House on any given day, I have the flexibility to do these other things that allow me to have conversations about any number of issues that I don't get to cover on the White House beat. So it's just like if you've been doing one kind of exercise for a long time and you start a different kind of exercise, it feels good to use those different muscles.
Do you have a sense that when you're doing programs like that, that you have the opportunity to express a little more of Ari Shapiro, your opinion, as opposed to the inability to do that as a reporter?
There's a difference between expressing opinion and expressing personality. And I think that I can express personality when I'm having conversations with people in a way that it's more difficult to do when you're sort of telling a story as a reporter.
Sure.
Although, I mean, you know, just for example, when I was guest hosting Talk of the Nation, we had a conversation about why romantic comedies are so terrible. And I said, you know, I've always thought the romantic comedies were sort of the female equivalent of horror stories, where movie producers know they can put cheap schlock on the screen, and just as teenage boys are going to flock to whatever the horror movie of the moment is, young women will flock to whatever the romantic comedy of the moment is. That was an opinion, I suppose. It wasn't a controversial political opinion,
sure,
but it's also the kind of thing you can say when you're hosting a program that you can't say when you're a reporter.
But you might have to be careful about political issues in doing a program like that.
Yeah, I would never express a political opinion. It's just not my role. But I can also be provocative and say, you know, are the technology of drones the problem, or is it the way that people use them that's the problem? And that's, I suppose, a thin line between asking a provocative question and expressing an opinion. I'm not even sure that an inference somebody would make about my opinion from drones on that question actually does reflect my, you know,
sure,
the goal is to elicit good conversation.
But we'll talk a little bit more about drones later in our discussion here, because it's getting a lot of attention right now in
Washington.
But in reference to the kind of thing we've been talking about just now, Judy Zimmerman asks a question, says, we hear you on NPR and also see you on PBS. How does that work?
Well, I was specifically on PBS after each of the presidential debates. I was covering the Romney campaign for the entire year of the election campaign, and Scott Horsley was covering the Obama campaign. And so it was NPR and PBS decided that after each debate, since Scott and I were in the same place, which was very rare during the campaign year, the two of us would go out to where the PBS TV cameras were, and we would talk to the news hour about the show. It sometimes felt like a show about the debates. And then separate from that, sometimes I will have a breaking news story or an important piece, and the news hour will call and ask me to be on the show, just as MSNBC or CNN or Fox might.
Yeah. We have another question related to your work during the Romney campaign. Diana wrote on Facebook, what did you like best and least about traveling with the Romney campaign?
The best thing was just getting to see the country in a way that I never had before. He would do, I don't know, 3 to 5 events a day. And at every rally, I would try to talk to a handful of people for just a few minutes each. But even just that gave me such a sense of the country that I never had before. Getting to see how New Hampshire is different from Colorado and how Florida is different from Ohio, and getting to hear stories about people's lives in this difficult economy, was a really incredible experience, and it just helped me understand the country in a way I hadn't before.
You know, those of us who are well beyond the Beltway often wonder if folks in Washington really give us any thought at all.
We give you thought, but we don't understand you the same way that we do when we're actually outside of Washington talking to people firsthand. I have so many vivid memories of people who I spoke with at rallies who just opened up and told me their stories, not knowing me at all, but being very honest with me about what they've experienced and what their families are going through. And hearing that firsthand from somebody is very different from reading about it.
I think it'd be very important doing what you do to have that that kind of insight as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
You surprised that Mitt Romney is going to be speaking at the CPAC conference and Chris Christie is not?
I'm less surprised that Mitt Romney is. I'm more surprised that Chris Christie is not. We're sort of in a moment of purity in the Republican Party, which is something that Romney struggled with the entire time. But ultimately, he was his party's nominee, and so it would have been a real shock if he had not been invited. It's also a shock to me that Chris Christie was not invited. His popularity right now is above 70%. He's considered a frontrunner for 2016. But his views on guns, his expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare, and other positions he's taken made CPAC view him, CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, this big gathering of conservatives in Washington, made them view him as sort of not an appropriate choice.
I'm backtracking a little bit now. We have another question related to something that we had discussed a little earlier. This is from Michael Honigfort. President Obama had been attempting to enlist the public to assist with his budget sequester dispute with the Republicans. Now he is attempting to build relationships through this dinner and other things that we have talked about and other overtures with legislators. Which approach do you expect will be more effective?
Well, you have to ask what the goal is. I mean, obviously the goal is to get a deal, but that's not the only goal. I think mobilizing the public is an end in and of itself, whether or not it actually leads to anything. During President Obama's first term, he sort of let his grassroots wither, and they learned from that mistake, and they're not doing it again. And so keeping his supporters engaged is something that the White House sees as really important, whether or not it leads to a deal on the budget crisis. I think you also have to work and talk with the people who are ultimately going to vote on the deal that you hope to get through Congress. It might not help, but it sure won't hurt.
Yeah. How much time does the president have, do you think, to make this a successful term? We hear that he's got about a year, and then the other things start with the congressional elections and then the presidential election.
Yeah.
That he doesn't have 4 years to get his things through.
That's true. Most people in Washington believe he's got 1.5 to 2 years to get really major legislation through on the scale of immigration reform and overhaul of the tax code, gun control, and so on. But one big White House strategy right now is to help Democrats win back the House in 2014, which suggests that they do see the possibility of getting something done between 2014 and 2016, because otherwise they would just be writing off the last 2 years of a second term.
I wonder how realistic that is.
It's going to be extremely tough. I don't think the, you know, wise sages of Washington are predicting Democrats taking back the House in 2014. But it's not impossible. I mean, Democrats pulled off something pretty incredible, gaining seats in the Senate in 2012. A lot of sort of lucky breaks came the Democrats' way. So it's not out of the question, but I don't think it's especially likely.
Do you know off the top of your head how many seats they have to win to do
that? Off the top of my head, I don't. There are so many people at NPR who are these political savants who just know all of those numbers by heart. I have to confess, I'm not among them.
Let's call Ken Rudin.
Exactly. He's one of them, a political junkie. Yeah.
We are talking with Ari Shapiro, the White House correspondent for NPR, and you are listening to St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Now, we continue our conversation. I'd like to talk a little bit about you. And how you're a very young guy. What are you, 32, 33?
I'm
34. You're an old man.
I'm an old man.
You've had really quite a fast-track career, haven't you? Do you sense that? Do you feel that you're
extraordinarily lucky to have had so many opportunities at NPR. I grew up at NPR. You know, I graduated from college and I went to intern for Nina Totenberg first thing out of the gate. And then I went to work on Morning Edition as a temp. I worked the overnight shift from 1 to 9 a.m., I started doing freelance reporting and traveled around a bit and just feel so lucky that NPR kept giving me opportunities to do more and new things.
I should mention that you went to Yale, graduated magna cum laude, which is not bad.
Thank you.
Not bad.
Thank
Congratulations to you for that. I was interested in the time with Nina Totenberg.
Uh-huh.
How intimidating might that have been for a youngster who listened to NPR all his life?
The best thing about working for Nina is that in the building, she has a reputation as this icon. You know, she's this woman who everyone respects so much and in some ways puts on a pedestal. And yet when you work with her, you learn firsthand that she is the nicest, sweetest, most wonderful person in the world. And so, of course, the first time you meet her, it's this sense of, oh, my God, the woman whose voice I've heard for years. But within a day, it's Nina. And so over the years, she's become one of my closest mentors and friends in the building. I talk to her every time there's an important issue, whether it's about a story or a career move or whatever it is. And she's just been such a great resource for me. I just love her dearly.
Can you give me an example of something she might have taught you that you might otherwise not have learned?
Well, I'm going to phrase this delicately, but when I was an intern and I would request things of people who she needed for a story, she may have at some point told me I needed to grow a pair.
Got it.
Which is acceptable on the radio, right? But to speak to sort of her caring about the people she works with, when I was finishing up my internship and did not know whether I would have a job, she knew that I liked to cook and she knew that I was living in this teeny studio apartment. And so she said, here's the plan, Ari. I'm going to throw a dinner party and hire you to cook, and you'll also be a guest, and I will invite a bunch of people who are friends of mine who could give you jobs. And so she threw this dinner party, invited a senior member of Congress who was a chairman of a committee. She invited a former deputy attorney general. I mean, this was like, you know, Washington power hitters coming to Nina's wow. home at her invitation. And then I made dinner and I sat down at the table with everybody and she said, okay, everybody, the reason you're here is that this is my intern Ari and he needs a job.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a story.
Yeah.
What a story that is.
Yeah.
Where do you want to be 5 years from now?
The truth is, and I know this sounds like a cop-out, I have never been able to predict where I would be in the next 5 years, and I could easily see myself spending my entire career at NPR. One of the great things about it is that it is such a place for growth and opportunity. It is one of the few news organizations in the country that is not dramatically scaling back. And so I don't have sort of a specific destination in mind, but I'm excited to sort of explore what the next possibilities could be.
But it is scaling back somewhat.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
Somewhat. We are moving, and so we're getting into a much less decrepit building, which is nice. But there are also serious financial challenges that the company is tackling.
Well, we've just moved. I don't know if you've been
It's a gorgeous
before.
Building.
It is
I don't
a
know if you can
building.
Hear on the radio how nice this is, but it's really
take our word for
beautiful.
It. It's great. My guest in studio is Ari Shapiro. He is the White House correspondent for NPR. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We continue our conversation with NPR White House correspondent and almost jack of all trades at NPR these days, it would seem, Ari Shapiro. It's great to have him in St. Louis. This is a recorded conversation that we had last evening. Nina Totenberg was a mentor of yours. You spent a long time at the Justice Department doing things relating to the world of the legal world, I should say. How surprised were you by Antonin Scalia's comments about racial entitlements?
I wasn't terribly surprised by them. I think Antonin Scalia has always sort of said what he thinks. What he thinks has been pretty consistently pretty conservative and averse to social programs. And I think in the last 10 years, he's sort of been even more and more outspoken than he was 10 years ago, which was pretty outspoken 10 years ago.
But he's a justice on the Supreme Court. You're not supposed to be quite so outspoken, I don't think.
Yeah, that's right. But he also has life tenure like all of the justices. And among all of them, he tends to be the most, I would say, unfiltered.
I was listening to Terry Gross's program, and she had talked with Sandra Day O'Connor yesterday and talked with Jeffrey Toobin following that. And Toobin, I think, was very, very good talking about that. And he said he would not be surprised if John Roberts sat down with Justice Scalia and said, you know, we can't have this sort of thing. Because Roberts is so protective
right,
of the image
right.
of the court.
So that's a huge difference between Scalia and Roberts. People often talk about the court in these very simplistic liberal wing, conservative wing terms. But each justice is very distinctive and individual. Scalia has been there forever. And he knows how he feels and what he thinks. And he feels no need to sort of answer or apologize to anyone for anything. Roberts is also extremely conservative, but as Chief Justice, he feels a sense of responsibility for the court, respect for the court, duty to the court that I'm sure Scalia feels, but it just does not inform his actions nearly as much as it does Roberts's actions. And so I think that's where that comes from.
Do you have any concerns about this so-called legislating from the bench with regard to the Supreme Court? A lot of people have been critical, thinking that that's exactly what's going on, and when the right side of the political spectrum has always been critical of that.
I think legislating from the bench, sort of like activist judge, is the phrase that people use to attack decisions that they disagree with. Mm-hmm. And there may be something seriously wrong with specific decisions. There may even be something seriously wrong with a long pattern of decisions, whether we're talking about a Supreme Court or an appeals court or any court. But the term legislating from the bench is just sort of, I think, an easy way to say this is bad.
Mm-hmm. You ran down a list of issues that you thought that the president was going to be working on, the fact that he'd have to do it in the next year and a half or so if he has a chance of being effective. Gun control is one of the things that you mentioned. You talked about immigration. Do you have a sense at this point, again, I'm not asking for opinion, but just a sense of how these things are likely to proceed?
Well, I think immigration is a much easier lift than gun legislation. Gun legislation actually encompasses several different elements, some of which may be easy to do, like universal background checks, some less easy, like limiting high-capacity magazines, some very, very difficult indeed, like a renewal of the assault weapons ban. Immigration is different because I think there is a consensus in the Republican Party that demographics are forcing Republicans to come to the table and deal with immigration. President Obama won 2/3 of the Latino vote in 2008. He won 3/4 of the Latino vote in 2012. Republicans do not want to see that pattern continue. This is the fastest growing minority group in the country, and the U.S. is projected to be a majority minority country by 2043. So for all of those reasons, I think we're going to see some kind of action on immigration. The only question is what the specific outlines of the bill will look like.
How about health care? Where is that going, or is
the
that
really
where it's
interesting development on healthcare is that some Republican governors who had objected very strenuously to what's now almost universally known as Obamacare are embracing parts of it. As I mentioned, Chris Christie agreed to accept the funding to expand Medicaid in his state of New Jersey. Rick Scott, the extremely conservative Tea Party governor of Florida, is coming on board to the great outcry of Republicans in his state who thought he was a purist.
Well, you've mentioned Florida. Let's mention Jeb Bush, who all of a sudden has surfaced and looking very much like he's getting ready to look at 2016 very seriously.
Jeb Bush just published a book and is doing the tour. The big headline from the book is that he favors a revision of the immigration program, but he does not favor citizenship for workers who are here without papers. The narrative I've heard, and I don't know this for a fact, but it would be very interesting if it's true, is that the book publishing world just did not move as fast as the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And so the 2012 election happened. Republicans took a look at the results and they said, oh, no, we have to change our position on immigration. But by that point, Jeb Bush's books were already, at the copier.
He's been doing quite a dance ever since, trying to straighten that out. I wonder if the White House is worried about Jeb Bush.
Well, I mean, listen, President Obama's not up for re-election, so he's not worried about anybody. But I think Jeb Bush has a ton of things going for him. He's a very popular former governor of a very important swing state. He speaks Spanish fluently. His wife is Latina. The big strike against him, honestly, is his last name. The Bush brand is so tainted in American politics right now that the question is, by 2016, will Jeb be able to overcome that taint, or will that taint have just sort of faded in time?
And if there are some missteps, such as apparently been the case with this whole thing on immigration, that certainly doesn't help very much.
Right. I should say, colleagues of mine who have covered him, who have talked to him, interviewed him, been on panels and such with him. I'm thinking specifically of Greg Allen, who covers Florida for NPR, and Julie Rovner, who covers health policy, speak incredibly highly of his grasp of policy, his attention to detail, and just his ability to sort of speak very, very fluently off the cuff about very, very complicated issues. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of candidate he is if he does run.
You know, I know people who live in Florida and lived there during the time that he was governor and say that he's probably the best governor that they've ever known, that he was so
attentive
to everything.
He's certainly very popular. No, very, very popular.
No question about that. I have another question here through Facebook from Hannah, who writes, is the West Wing's representation of the White House press corps anything close to reality? Inquiring minds want to know.
There was an aide who used to work in the White House and has since left. And when I started on this beat, he said to me, you will find that the real Air Force One is much more like the movie than the real West Wing is like the TV show. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, if you see the Harrison Ford movie, the plane actually looks almost exactly like what you see in the Harrison Ford movie, minus the escape pod.
You're not talking about the movie Fright, I hope.
The movie Air Force One.
Okay, got it.
You know, another Air Force One moment from the movies, I have to say, during the Super Bowl, there was an ad for Iron Man 3, and there was an image of Air Force One blowing up and Iron Man swooping in to save them. And the part of the plane that blows up, everybody in the White House press corps noted, was the part that the press sits in. Mm. So they went for the journalists first.
Got it. Changing course again, Ari, for our conversation. What's this singing thing all about?
What's the singing thing? So there's a band from my hometown of Portland, Oregon. They're called Pink Martini. They're sort of a mini orchestra. There are 12 people in the band. It includes strings and horns and 3 percussionists and occasionally they bring in a harpist and so on. I've been a fan of theirs since I was a kid. And I became friends with them maybe 10, 15 years ago. And then a few years ago, the band leader, who's the pianist, asked if I would be interested in singing something on their next album. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was joking. And the next thing I knew, I was in Portland in the studio recording with them. I thought that would be a one-off. And then he said, well, we need to find a time for you to perform live. How about the Hollywood Bowl? So the first time I performed live with them was in front of 18,000 people at this iconic venue in the Hollywood Hills. And then I recorded a few other songs for a few other albums, and I've continued touring with them whenever my schedule allows it.
What did they see in you that made them think that you would be a singer worthy of their
accompaniment? I had thrown a party for them in D.C. They had come to D.C. to perform, and I invited them, and there just happened to be another Portland band in town at the same time that I invited over, and a bunch of my D.C. friends. It was the summer. We had this big barbecue in the backyard, and then it sort of went late into the night and turned into a sing-along around our piano upstairs. And so everybody was up there singing until the early hours of the morning. And at the time, the band had written a song about a woman who had been jilted. The song was based on a Schubert melody, and it was sort of a Latin tango. It was called And Then You're Gone. They decided to take the same Schubert melody, put a big band swing beat to it, and write a song from the man's perspective called But Now I'm Back. Mm-hmm. And they had that concept. And then they thought, oh, well, we don't really have anyone to sing this song. So they just sort of tabled the idea, and then I came along.
You have picked the right song to talk about, because we have some of it we'd like to play for our
audience.
Oh, terrific. But Now I'm Back. The album is Splendor in the Grass, and the band, of course, is Pink Martini. And here is Ari Shapiro.
Won't you please open the door? I brought you flowers, been waiting hours, can't stand it anymore. So here's what happened when you were napping. I just went out for a snack. I was feeling famished and then I vanished. But now I'm back.
Now he's back. Had a snack. Now he's back.
My heart is burning for that love of ours, yearning. That sea of stars, let me in so I can prove to you that no one else can love you, girl, the way that I do. 'Cause I'll be back.
He'll be back.
All right, Ari Shapiro. If the NPR gig, if the NPR gig ever begins to falter, you've got another career.
Thank
for you.
Thank you very much.
You know, you sound, and your voice sounds like you're having an awful lot of fun.
Such a crazy fantasy to sing with these guys in these iconic venues around the country with these musicians who I've admired so long. I will sit in the audience during sound check, listening to them go through the rest of the set and just pinch myself that I get to do this.
You know, you sound like you're having fun, and I mean that in a very positive way also, when you're on the radio and when you're talking about serious things. There's something about your voice and the way you project it.
I hope so. I never want it to feel dutiful. Yeah. Ira Glass once said something that really stuck with me. He, of course, is host of This American Life, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that in every story you do, whether it's the most sort of routine, daily, quick turnaround, nothing story, there should be one moment that you are proud of that is distinctly you, that another person would not have done in exactly that way, whether it's a turn of phrase or a metaphor or a use of tape or the way you structured the story. One thing you should be able to point to that you say, ah, I'm really glad I did that way. And so I try to bring that to each story that I do.
And a lot of the people do. I mean, it's very, very clear when listening to NPR and their people. They're doing exactly what you're talking about. I'm always struck by the number of female correspondents on NPR in some of the toughest places in the world.
That's right.
I don't know why I should be. People will probably say that's a sexist comment, but it's very noticeable.
And it is different from other news organizations, and it has been part of NPR's DNA from the very beginning. This is one of the things that I love to talk to Nina Totenberg, my mentor who we discussed earlier, about, is that when she was hired at NPR, no other major news organization in the country was allowing women to do serious news. And for that reason, NPR has these incredible women like Cokie Roberts, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, Susan Stamberg, And it's just such an intrinsic part of the DNA. And so today we have in war zones overseas, Deb Amos, Kelly McEvers, just, you know, these really tough, incredible reporters who happen to be women.
Yeah. I had an opportunity to chat here with Linda Wertheimer a couple of years ago, and we talked about the same sort of thing. And I asked her about it, and I said, you know, why were so many women hired early on? And she said, because the people who were running the joint thought they could get more bang for their buck, which I thought was an interesting way to put it.
People don't really appreciate this today, but Susan Stamberg was the first woman ever to host a national nightly news program. She was first host of All Things Considered. I mean, that was groundbreaking.
Yeah. She was in here a year or two ago. She tells a wonderful story. I mean, her pictures that she paints with words are just absolutely stunning. And it turns out that we were born about 2 miles apart, about a month apart.
You're kidding.
In New Jersey, yeah, of all things. So that was kind of fun. We chatted about that.
She's so wonderful.
We are talking with Ari Shapiro, the White House correspondent for NPR. And you are listening to St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. What's ahead? Do you know what's ahead?
What's ahead? Well, hopefully something other than careening from crisis to crisis in President Obama's term. We've got pretty much an agenda, you know. There's, as we said, immigration, gun control, tax reform. Gay rights is going to be a huge issue with the Supreme Court hearing these challenges to the Defense of Marriage Act and Prop 8, California's same-sex marriage law. And I also expect that in this term, President Obama is going to do more foreign travel than he did before. The only trip so far that's been announced is Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan later this month. But I think in the next 4 years, he'll be overseas a lot more than he was in the last 4 years.
Yeah, that brings to mind what's going on in that part of the world, in Syria, and the concerns about Iran. And he goes to Israel at a time when he is not getting along very well with Mr. Netanyahu.
Although, to be fair, there has not been much time in the last 4 years that he has gotten along well with Mr. Netanyahu. And it comes right after this election where Netanyahu, of course, is still in power. But the election did not go as expected. A centrist group that sort of urges moderation did much, much better than they were expected to. And so Netanyahu is sort of in a slightly different situation than he was just a few months ago. I don't think anybody is expecting a major breakthrough. There's just no groundwork for it on this trip. But it will be President Obama's first trip to Israel, which symbolically is very significant. And so people will be paying close attention.
I wonder if anybody is anticipating any action beyond the $60 million in non-lethal aid that we are now offering to the rebel groups in Syria.
There's such concern about extremists among the rebels in Syria. I mean, we know that extremists are among the rebels in Syria. And so on the one hand, you look at 70,000 Syrians killed by Bashar al-Assad and his army, and you think, how can you not give whatever assistance the rebels want? On the other hand, weapons don't just disappear when a conflict ends. And so the White House has had really big struggles over this question of, do you arm the rebels or do you restrict what your assistance to non-lethal aid and potentially sit back and watch tens of thousands more people be killed. Some people have called this President Obama's Rwanda, referring, of course, to the genocide that Bill Clinton said was the greatest regret of his presidency, not intervening sooner.
Yeah. Only have about a minute left. You'd mentioned the Defense of Marriage Act and some of the things that are before the president. What turned the president around on the issue of the gay world?
Well, he says it was his friends, his family, his staff, his kids would come home from school and say, Dad, I can't understand how this could be an issue in your mind. He also, you know, he watches TV. He and Governor Romney both say one of their favorite shows is Modern Family, the sitcom that includes a gay married couple. So the country's changing really fast on this issue.
It is indeed. And Ari Shapiro, this has been a very fast hour with you. I'm so happy that you made it into St. Louis.
I really enjoyed it. Great to talk with you.
I did too. And I hope we'll have a chance to do it again and you enjoy your time here in St. Louis.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk with Stephen Jarvie, the newly appointed resident conductor of the St. Louis Symphony, with wildlife photographer Florian Schultz. And in the next installment of Soundbites, produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll take a look at the contribution Ben Perumba's restaurants are making in the Botanical Heights neighborhood. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll meet Mary Beth Tinker on the 25th anniversary of her Supreme Court case concerning First Amendment rights of students. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Doerr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.